we spent so much time separating everything from everything else, apparently because we thought that would add to our convenience. But of course, all it did was force us to be more mobile.
You're listening to Thinking Out Loud Cities, conversations about the issues impacting and shaping where we live. Jeff Speck is a city planner and urban designer who advocates for more walkable cities. He's the author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. He was in Montreal speaking at the Next City Vanguard Conference in 2017, hosted by Concordia University. In this episode, he's interviewed by Silvano Della Latta, professor of geography and urban planning at Concordia's Faculty of Arts and Science. He's an architect, urbanist, and educator with a PhD from Cornell. His research focuses on public spaces and alternative uses. Think street vending, graffiti, public assembly, and protest. He studied alternative planning processes and the role of grassroots movements, like Occupy Wall Street, for example. We joined the conversation at Concordia's Studio C just before Jeff Speck's public talk. What makes a walkable city?
I'm Silvano Della Latta.
And I'm Jeff Speck.
First, some basics. What is a walkable city?
A walkable city, I like to say, and maybe it's because our standards have been lowered some over the years, but a walkable city, from most of our experience, is a city in which the automobile is not necessary. So a walkable city may very well have a lot of cars in it, and many people may choose to own cars and may drive on occasion or even often. But I think a city, at least in North America, qualifies as walkable if it offers citizens the opportunity to have full and productive and enjoyable lives without that a mandatory automobile as prosthetic device.
Before cars came about, cities were obviously walkable. After cars came about, we developed this enormous network of infrastructure to accommodate for cars. We inherit this infrastructure that is too big sometimes to be removed, to be rebuilt. How can we make a city walkable when we have such divisive infrastructure in the cities today? What are the design and planning challenges for this kind of urban condition?
Well, it's funny because my experience personally is I was trained as an architect, and I thought I was going to be an architect of buildings. And then I got very excited about the new work that was being done in what was not yet called the new urbanism, but now is known as this movement that was positioning itself as a alternative to suburban sprawl. And so I went from being someone who thought that he was an architect to someone who was a urban designer. Mm-hmm. And then I went into communities, as I still do, with the goal, or perhaps the mandate, if I'm hired to do so, to make the city more walkable. And I found that I've transitioned largely from being an urban designer to being a street designer, because it is often these inherited infrastructures of automotive facilities that are the impediment and the danger to having a walkable city. Now, obviously, there's the grandest scale of the, you know, decanted suburbs in which the entire urban model is based around the presumption of automobile use. And those parts of the landscape are very hard to reimagine or, frankly, to reform into a more walkable shape. Additionally, there's the, more in America than in Canada, but everywhere there are the freeways that barrel through our cities or perhaps cut between neighborhoods as freeways. Mm-hmm. And those are hard to change as well unless you bring them down to the ground. But the typical American city street used to be walkable. Mm-hmm. And say North American, and now typically, very often, is not walkable because of subtle changes that have been made that can be undone. But the thing that I spend most of my time on in cities is restriping what's between the curbs. Mm-hmm. And acknowledging that typically the lanes don't need to be as wide as they are or as many as they are. Mm-hmm. And that your typical urban street has an opportunity, therefore, of asphalt that can be put to other use. That other use may be the parallel parking or angle parking that was once there, providing activity and protection, frankly, to the curb that's often gone. Or more often than not, as you see in the great changes that are happening in our cities these days, can be put to bicycle infrastructure.
So you mentioned briefly about the difference between Canadian and U.S. cities. Do you see, what are the subtle differences? And do you think that what the ideas that you have explored can be implemented
Canadian cities? There are subtle and there are less subtle differences. I was joking with my host that I have a portion of my talk where I talk about how to hide a parking garage. And I take my generic slides and I load them into my presentation. And then I zoom around the city on Google Earth and I find all your downtown parking garages that need help. And I spent 5 minutes zooming around downtown Montreal and hardly found a one. And that's actually a shocking difference. Okay. Maybe subtle on the grand scale, but at the localized scale, it's a shocking difference between a typical Canadian city and a typical American city. It's just the sheer amount of automotive and infrastructure that we have for parking, let alone driving. Mm-hmm. But there's an incredible article. It's probably 15 years old now, by a Canadian professor named Patrick Condon. He's from Vancouver.
From Vancouver, yeah.
And it's called American and Canadian Cities, Our Differences Are the Same. And what it recounts is, and I talk about it in my book, Walkable City, is that he and his students set out to study what made our cities different from each other. And actually, they ignored international boundaries and just looked city by city. And they found, you know, they charted a whole bunch of statistics against each other. And they found the strongest correlation, and I'll tell you what kind in a minute, between two things, between inner city property values and highway investment. And it was an inverse correlation. It didn't matter whether the city was Canadian or American, but it actually explains why so many of your inner cities did so much better in the second half of the 20th century than ours did. That the more a city invested in highways, the worse its inner city property values were. And in fact, you could chart an individual city over time, like St. Louis. And as the here I'm making hand motions to illustrate, but as the highway investment went up over a period of 5 years, the property values dropped. Then they stopped building highways for a while, and the property values plateaued. Then they started building highways again, and the properties dipped again. I think the healthiest Canadian cities, even like Vancouver, are the ones that had the least intrusion of highways. Not that I'm anti-car.
So now let's talk about a little bit of the differences between European and North American cities. So now, a large portion of European cities developed before the time motorized vehicles came about. Most of them developed spontaneously around main streets or main roads or ports. In the case of European cities, making cities walkable seems easier since they have the infrastructure for it, because a large portion of the city was built before cars came about. Let's take, for example, Barcelona, who have very interesting plans for rendering the city walkable. Here, all it takes is taking for them is to regulate the streets in terms of speed and redirecting public transportation and heavy traffic, and then leaving some space that is pedestrian priority, not necessarily completely walkable.
Right.
As in the case of most North American cities, that is not the case. We have these cities developed around the idea of the automobile.
The typical North American city developed initially before the automobile, and the parts of those cities that did develop before the automobile are the parts that are typically now the healthiest for walking and, as you suggest, can be most easily made more walkable. Now, some of those cities, or I should say segments of cities that were walkable, have been undermined or even destroyed by kowtowing to the automobile or to the idea that you can be a more successful city by being a more drivable city. I think something that we've proven false. But whether American, North American, American versus Canadian or European, it's principally the date that the city was built that is the determination of how walkable it is. But when you get outside the cities, that's where you see the greatest distinction. And I think Canada is not so different from the U.S. From the air when you look at its suburbs. I like to say that the typical Canadian city is as good as the U.S.'s best, mm-hmm. And the typical Canadian suburb is as bad as the U.S.'s worst. You know, you had the same kind of rigorous, ruthless set of rules around suburban development that made it the way it was. The dendritic, you know, branching road systems that go from highway to arterial to collector to cul-de-sac, the same setback requirements, the same zoning, whether de facto or de jure, of uses into large areas where only one thing is happening, that make walkability actually impossible. So the question that many of us face as planners is what to do about that stuff. And we used to not have to care because it was where mostly wealthy people lived. But at least in the U.S., you know, unlike perhaps in Canada, where much of the wealth stayed in the cities in the second half of the 20th century, in the U.S., almost all of it left the cities. And some downtowns, you know, almost nobody still lives in. But because the suburbs in the U.S. were kind of a middle-class and an upper-class phenomenon, we planners could hold our noses and say, oh, I'm going to focus all my energy at the city where the real action is and the real people are. But of course, now in America, we have a lot of people who have no choice but to live in the suburbs. And a lot of the suburbs are becoming predominantly lower income. So now we have a mandate. What can we do to make these people's lives better, particularly since one of the biggest challenges they face is the transportation burdens put upon them by living in this automotive environment? Mm-hmm. A quote-unquote working family, which is some income definition by the federal government, is actually now paying more for transportation than for housing because of this pattern where they're required to own automobiles. What we've learned is that the easiest things to fix are the things that are under single ownership. So an office park is pretty easy to turn into a mixed-use town center. A shopping mall that's struggling is pretty easy to turn into a mixed-use town center, and there are plenty of good examples of that being done in the U.S. What seems hard, if not impossible, to reform are these mile upon mile of single-family subdivisions or even multifamily subdivisions that are based in this non-walkable framework.
Now, you're from Boston. And
yes.
So Boston, it has an interesting history of modernism and urban renewal, reshaping a city that develops spontaneously, very much like a traditional city in Europe. Then it went through this violent process of urban transformation.
Urban removal, as we call it.
Exactly, that transformed. But Boston is taking steps back, and both in kind of adapting this infrastructure. These are huge projects that are being that are expensive to readapt, and then examples like what they're doing right now at the Boston City Hall Plaza, that is more tactical, mm-hmm. that is more about pulverizing the different uses as opposed to what the modernist thought, one single use for one huge plaza.
Yep.
How can you conciliate these two? One, the strategic vision of reinterpreting a huge piece of infrastructure like the highway, and then the tactical, the more like day-to-day, small scale.
Well, the City Hall Plaza itself is becoming an historic landmark in its own right. I mean, it's been there for quite some time. But in Boston, for those who aren't familiar, the two principal modernist urban design moves that were laid on that city were, I don't know actually which was first in terms of time, but I'll say first was the destruction of the Central West End, which was a whole corner of the city. I mean, I think it was about 50 acres, but when you're talking about serious urbanism, that's a ton of blocks and people and places. I don't think it was the Italians. I think it was principally the Irish and the African Americans. But it was called a slum, and it really wasn't a slum. And I was reading just this morning a 1990 interview by James Howard Kunstler of Jane Jacobs, and they talked a lot about that. And it was the destruction of the Central West End in order to create modernist urbanism that catalyzed, in her mind, a lot of this hatred or acknowledging the failure of this approach to city building. And, you know, she always said, you know, this isn't the saving of cities, this is the sacking of cities, in her great book, The Death and Life of Great American Places. But first, they removed a very vital series of neighborhoods that made up kind of one whole quarter of the city, and put in big plazas, big buildings, government structures, some tower-in-the-park condominiums that have a sign as you drive by to go to the airport that says, the first sign says, if you live here, and the second one says, you'd be home now. And someone once draped over that when I was driving by. The second sign said, you'd be a yuppie a-hole instead of that. But that was the first great insult. The second, which may have happened first, but it was around the same time, was the driving through the center of the city of a central artery that I remember very well through most of my life in Boston. I lived there, I lived away, and I've moved back, which was this very tall, elevated highway that went right through the heart, separating it from its north end, which was the Italian neighborhood, and provided not only a quick way through the downtown, but very privileged views that some people miss, looking down into tenement windows and historic neighborhoods. The Big Dig, which probably finished, 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. Multi-billion dollar effort, I think $30 billion, if I'm not mistaken. I just read that. I find it hard to believe. I thought I remembered it was just a couple, but billions of dollars, mostly federal money, thanks to Congressman Tip O'Neill's power in the U.S. Congress, and the sort of thing that almost no cities can afford to do anymore, although it appears Seattle's doing it right now, where the, in the case of Boston, the highway was buried, and there's a lovely, I should say, still developing into something lovely, green linear park as kind of a second emerald necklace connecting parts of Boston. And it's amazing now how the North End, which felt completely disassociated from the city, is now really a part of the rest of the city.
Can we think of ways of planning walkable cities from the bottom up?
The first role of regular citizens is to show up, because unfortunately the public process that we have in North America is that people self-select to show up at meetings, and they're either people who happen to have more time than other people, which kind of really cuts down the mm-hmm. segments of the population that are coming, or they're the people that have something to lose from the development show up. Now, bear in mind, we have a history of urban planning making places worse in the U.S. rather than making them better for a solid 50 years. So there's every reason for people to be suspicious and negative. But the typical condition in a typical public meeting you have around getting projects done in cities is that the people show up are mostly folks who have a vested interest. And that vested interest is principally negative. And I don't mean to demean their role. They typically do have something to lose, and it's probably smart for them to fight the projects. But what we need is some way to have a more democratic participation mm-hmm. in our planning processes. So a typical tactical urbanist exercise, for example, would involve a main street where people acknowledge, or there's a feeling among the locals, that a certain parking lot would be better as a plaza. And the street itself has maybe a lane or two more than it needs to handle the traffic that's on it, and it should have bike lanes. And maybe the parallel parking was removed and needs to be put back on. And maybe there should be some better street trees, and we can bring in potted trees for a day and make that happen. There's been many, many cases where the city has said, wow, this is great, we're going to make it permanent. Often it's as simple as something that's like a neck down. You know, and a neck down is when you stick the curb, the corner of the curb at your corner into the intersection as kind of a bulb that shortens the walking, you know, the crossing distances mm-hmm. between the two sides of the street, and actually causes cars to turn the corner more slowly, which makes the crossing much safer. Sometimes it's as simple as something like that.
Well, in the spirit of brainstorming together and thinking out loud, which is the spirit of this podcast, we've been our own research collective and community engagement collective called Cities by Citizens. We've been working on this, you just mentioned democratization. So we work on the democratization of city making. We look at post-industrial sites, and what we do is we bring different stakeholders to participate to come up with strategies to restitch the urban fabric that is divided.
My whole career has been focused on identifying what makes a place more walkable, what makes a place likely to convince people to make the choice to walk as opposed to getting in a car or finding their way around some other way. And you know as well as I do that a human on foot is a very different animal than a human who's either in a vehicle or especially driving a vehicle, in which, you know, your relationship to all other humans is essentially either competing for asphalt or having your life threatened, right, when you're mm-hmm. driving. So the goal is to create as many pedestrians as possible, be it on mm-hmm. foot or in wheelchairs if necessary, or I like to think of cyclists as kind of proto-pedestrians or maybe a more advanced form of pedestrian. But if I were taking on that challenge of like a post-industrial interstitial space between two walkable areas, I have a very set, hierarchy of strategies that I would apply to actually accomplishing that quality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with some of those safety things that we talked about regarding the number of lanes and the width of the lanes and the behavior of the vehicle vis-a-vis the behavior of the pedestrian. But a lot of it also, and as an urban designer, you'll understand this, a lot of it is spatial. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about the four, my general theory of walkability talks about the four things that are necessary for people to make the choice to walk. And the walk has to be useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. Mm-hmm. Useful has to do with mixing uses again, not having zones the way we used to, and having things within walking distance. Safe is the stuff we were talking about. Mm-hmm. But comfortable and interesting has to do with what is shaping the space. We planners like to use as sticky edges. Mm-hmm. It's first of all, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, but we believe, I think most new urbanists like me, believe that a space really isn't comfortable. An urban space really isn't comfortable unless it has good edges. Mm-hmm. You know, a room is only as good as its walls. A plaza is only as good as its walls. And when we're planning, we like to create a series of outdoor living rooms that have the proper spatial definition, because all animals, humans among them, we are seeking, that the evolutionary biologists tell us, we're simultaneously seeking both prospect and refuge. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to see your predators, and you want to know that your flanks are covered from attack. And if your flanks don't feel covered from attack, you don't feel safe. And that's in our bones. We can't help it. And so a key strategy for connecting spaces that are otherwise disconnected is actually to give them good edges. But then, of course, you need the edges to be sticky. They can't just be blank walls. They can't just be parking structures, right? They need to have eyes on the street. They ideally, as you would learn in a pattern language, they need to be kind of semi-public, semi-private. The more interstitial between public and private space you can have, like a front porch or a shop awning or anything that is kind of half community-owned and half privately-owned, that starts to blur the boundaries between public and private and makes places stickier, right? So there's mm-hmm. all these tricks. A project I know that you might know that exemplifies this approach is called the CAP at Union Station, mm-hmm. and it's in Columbus, Ohio. And it's one of these places where two lively, walkable neighborhoods were completely separated by the gulf of a submerged highway. And one of the highway bridges had to be rebuilt, and the city by the state, and the city paid $1.9 million to the state, and they built a wider bridge. And then on the bridge, the wider bridge, they gave the flanks to a developer for free, and the developer put up shops. So now it's like a Ponte Vecchio, you know, mm-hmm. or one of these, or the Rialto Bridge, you know, in Venice. It's one of these bridges that has shops on the side. Mm-hmm. You actually don't even know you're crossing the highway. It was not an expensive project. And actually the Short North neighborhood, which is the neighborhood just north of downtown, that the highway separated from downtown, has come back to life as a function of this one investment in stitching together a space that was unwalkable.
Permeability of when it comes to edges and overlapping mm-hmm. of activities, things that the modernists didn't like much. They wanted to think of one space for each activity yeah. and everything separated.
There's a new book called Dream Cities that's very good. I forget the name of the author, but it's called Dream Cities. And it was quoting, I believe, Norman Bel Geddes about Futurama, which is the 1939 yeah. World's Fair, and the city of the future. And it said, and I'm sorry, I'm going to mangle the quote, but it essentially said, we are going to separate all the different functions of the city from each other in order to make it more convenient.
Exactly.
And this is like, you look back and you're like, how did he say that? What did he mean? How did people believe it? And how did it gain all of this traction that somehow separating housing from working to shopping would make life easier? I say that access is the new mobility. We spent so much time separating everything from everything else, apparently because we thought that would add to our convenience. But of course, all it did was force us to be more mobile. And everyone talks about mobility as a great thing. And in our given city, because everything is so separated, mobility is a great thing, but why did we have to separate everything from everything else?
There was also the idea of efficiency and convenience, as if we were animals that were looking only for that in life. Like you said, you look for the path that is more interesting, not necessarily the most efficient. Sometimes we want to take a longer walk.
But it's less efficient. That's what I don't get. This is where, like, I need a 1939 to 2017 translator. Because I don't understand in what kind of brain separating everything from everything else was considered more efficient or more convenient.
I think it only made it easier for the planners to understand the drawings. These are the only lives that were made easier.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, Le Corbusier, and I have this quote, which I'll now botch, in our book, Suburban Nation, that I wrote with my mentors, Andre Stuani and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg. But he basically said, in describing his radiant city, the city of the future in which everything was so separated from everything else. He said, all of this will require vehicles and gears and engines and tires, so there will be work for all. I think the implication was that, auto manufacturing, as occurred in the U.S., auto manufacturing was kind of a make-work effort.
Oh, and an inescapable question that you've all perhaps been asked before, the relationship between walkability and gentrification. It attracts people, that attracts money, it attracts businesses, that could cause gentrification.
It's the question I would like to escape.
Okay.
Because there's no easier or good answer for it. Another word for gentrification is improvement. Mm-hmm. If you're a planner, that's your job to improve places. Sometimes I'm brought to places where I say, you shouldn't improve anymore. I mean, maybe in fact, you should be directing the planner to those parts of your city that aren't yet at risk of much gentrification. And I think most American cities, I can't speak to Canadian cities, but most U.S. cities still have sizable portions of them that are well before gentrification, and you can improve them quite a bit without causing much displacement. And of course, the operative term is not gentrification but displacement. I was working in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Portsmouth, New Hampshire is a lovely city. It's become much lovelier in the last 20 years. They have a downtown, which is a pair of one-way streets. We know time and time again, when you convert a one-way pair back to the two-way traffic it once held, that places come back to life. They become better. Properties become more valuable. And I told them, because when I lecture in a place, I like to bring best practices to that place. And I told them, I said, this would be better as a two-way street, and I even showed them how to do it. And then I said, but I don't think you should do it because you've already got, like, J. Crew coming in. And, what was once a whole bunch of local mom-and-pop stores are starting to be displaced by chains. And I said, this is not a rhetorical question. Do you want to be better? Because I think some places are good enough, and, in fact, you'll lose a lot of the quality by making them too much better.
To conclude, this more than a question, if that's okay, I'm going to give you the name of a city, and if you can tell me one idea.
Just like a Rorschach test?
Yes.
So should I tell you the first word that pops into my head when you name the city?
Exactly.
Or no.
In relation to walkability and accessibility.
So an idea for making it better?
An idea about...
Or maybe from that city.
From that city.
You're testing my geographic knowledge. I've been to 49 U.S. states, so I'll try.
Okay.
And around the world.
Copenhagen.
Okay, one word. Well, five times as many people bike to work as drive to work in Copenhagen, and there's no reason why any city can't do that if they really want to.
Portland.
Portland, Oregon drives 20% less than it did 20 years ago, and that ends up equating to about 3% of all GDP because they made the choice to have an urban growth boundary and not invest in highways.
Okay, Detroit.
Detroit between 20 and 2010 censuses lost population, but the inner city gained population. And since 2010, even more so, and they now have more people living downtown than they did a year ago. There's definitely a donut ring of incredible abandonment, but it exemplifies how even in struggling and depopulated cities, people want to be in center cities.
Okay, San Francisco.
San Francisco is where I would live if I wasn't tied to Boston. San Francisco is, the West Coast city that did the least to undermine its urban fabric, and it benefits from that, of the big cities.
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles is a city of great neighborhoods. The problem is you can't just live in one of them.
And finally, Montreal.
Montreal is the most walkable, most livable, and most delightful city, at least in the east half of North America.
Okay, Jeff, thank you very much. Again, welcome to Montreal. Welcome to Next City. Welcome to Concordia.
Thanks for the really fun talk.
This podcast was created and produced by the Thinking Out Loud team at Concordia University's Studio C. Thanks to Jeff Speck and Silvano Dell'Olata and the Next City Vanguard Conference. Listen to previous TOL Cities episodes or check out the TOL 2067 series, all about research and the future. Can we speculate on what's coming next? What will 2067 look like? Big ideas, provocative conversation. Listen in at concordia.ca/TOL or wherever you get your podcasts.